episode 26, the July 2018 episode of the Bloodstream Podcast, is made possible by Shire, as have the other 25, actually. For more than 70 years, Shire has sought to develop patient-focused innovation to raise global standards of care and advancements in treatments to help improve outcomes for every person with hemophilia. Visit bleedingdisorders.com to learn more about Shire and their commitment to the bleeding disorders community. We have an excellent July episode to bring you here. But before we jump in, I wanted to make you aware of a few other cool things going on at Bloodstream Media and Believe. Depression and suicide prevention was the central topic for the Ask the Expert interview, which is going to be coming out next Monday, the last Monday of July, with Debbie De La Riva. So Debbie, who was the former, I believe, executive director of the Texas Bleeding Disorders I'm forgetting the name of the chapter, but she was a former executive director. Her husband Jorge was the chair and is now vice chair of the board of directors of NHF. Her son Jorge Jr. has hemophilia. Her daughter Christina De La Riva, very active in NYLI and throughout the community. But really on the heels of Barry Hardy's death earlier this year, Debbie kind of returned to her roots, so to speak, in doing some counseling work related to depression and suicide prevention. So Chris Bombardier, host of that podcast, and I, we actually decided that the two of us would talk with Debbie on that interview because both he and I have been outspoken about our mental health battles, and we thought it might just make for all the more dynamic conversation for the three of us to be involved. So next Monday, you'll hear me with Chris on the Ask the Expert podcast talking about mental health, depression, suicide prevention, and then interviewing Debbie on those topics as well. So definitely want to check that out, along with the most recent Powering Through podcast, which features my very cool cousin, who is a Paralympic world record holder, Lacey J. Henderson, Seth Rohani, who is another impressive athlete with hemophilia and paraplegia, and Kathy Bombardier, Chris's mother, to talk about what it's like to be the mom of a very active boy with hemophilia and how you try to best navigate that. So check out those podcasts. Make sure that you're subscribed to this, the Ask the Expert and the Powering Through podcast. You can find them on iTunes. You can find them on Spotify. You can find them on SoundCloud. Where are you listening right now? Make sure to download and subscribe to these so that you'll get the most recent episodes, including that upcoming episode with Debbie. I think that's going to be a really important one. In other Believe-related but non-podcast news, Stop the Bleeding, Season 8. We have released 6 of our 10 episodes from this season already on stbhemo.com. Episodes like Do You Bleed in Magic?, where we have a magic show take place by an older gentleman with hemophilia, the character anyway. Let's Get Physical Therapy, our most recent HTC episode, where we introduce the new physical therapist. For anyone who follows along with the show, I think you both will and will not be surprised by who's joining that crew, who's joining the comprehensive care team from our legacy cast. And the Ultimate Bleeding Disorders PSA, which might be one of my favorite all-time episodes of Stop the Bleeding, because it's, well, ridiculous. So catch up if you haven't, stbhemo.com. 2 more quick announcements to make. The Teen Impact Awards, honoring teens affected by bleeding disorders who are making a positive impact in their home, school, or community, an awards show that takes place the opening night of NHF's Bleeding Disorders Conference, formerly known as Annual Meeting. It's going to be this year, the Thursday of NHF in October, but we have just opened the nominations for the Teen Impact Awards. So if you know a teen who in the last year has done something to make an impact in their home, school, or community, and you believe that they are deserving of a platform and a moment of recognition for their activity, let us know. That's what the Teen Impact Awards is all about. You can find more information on the program, the nomination process, FAQs, and the rest at teenimpactawards.com. And then we also have Breaking Through, a brand new musical theater intensive that we are doing in conjunction with BioMarin, using musical theater and the arts as a means of teaching young people, teens affected by bleeding disorders, once again, primarily hemophilia, but there are spots available for teens affected by bleeding disorders of all kinds, and both patients as well as siblings and children of people with bleeding disorders. The program will bring a group of 25 to New York for a long weekend in November, where we will go through a number of different exercises and classes to demonstrate the therapeutic and healing power of the arts, and specifically music theater, all while building an original musical that there will be a performed staged reading of at the end of the program at New World Stages in New York City, which is an incredible off-Broadway venue right in the heart of Times Square. I think Avenue Q ran there for quite a long time. That's breaking through. It'll take place this fall for 25 people it'll culminate in the performance of Hemophilia the Musical, an original musical that will be created in collaboration with not just the teens who are participating in the program, but all teens who applied and submitted materials that we will be considering as we construct the musical. So this is a big deal program, and you can learn more about that at Breaking Through, THROUGH, hemophilia.com. And of course, there'll be links to both of those in the program notes. So Teen Impact Awards, if you know inspiring teens who are making an impact. Breaking Through, if you know teens who may benefit from an arts-styled music theater program as a means of skill building as well as healing and understanding the therapeutic value of the arts at breakingthroughhemophilia.com. So there you go. There are my top of the show pieces of info I want to get out to you, but let's get on with the program now. Bring Natalie in and in earnest start episode 26 of the Bloodstream Podcast right now. Hello and welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast. You're already laughing at me. Episode 26, July 16th, 2018. I am Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm still Natalie Lynch.
On this episode, for the first time, ASH, ISTH, NHF, and WFH, along with other letters, no, just those ones, are collaborating on developing clinical practice guidelines. First time they've done that, and in this case, those guidelines are on the diagnosis and management of von Willebrand disease, the world's most common bleeding disorder. What does this mean, and how might it impact you? We'll discuss in today's comment segment. Natalie presents a story on the STEP therapy bill headed to the Rhode Island State House in our Like segment. Community member Lydia Ruiz shares her An Unexpected Blessing story in this month's Share segment, and expectant mom Rebecca Haber sits down with Natalie and I to discuss how her pregnancy led to discovering that she both carries and has hemophilia C, factor 11 deficiency, only one in 100,000 births, in this month's interview segment. All that and more coming up on this episode. Welcome to Bloodstream. Natalie, are you looking forward to today's interview?
I am. Yeah, very much so.
It's also unusual that we're actually recording these other segments on the same day as the interview.
I know.
And that they're listening to this part just before we actually record the interview, and then they'll hear us talk about that later today and in the podcast.
It's wild.
Once again, I think there's a reoccurring theme of my liking to talk about time and the movement of time during this banter and housekeeping introduction, whether it's the dates in the calendar, what time we're recording, where we were when we recorded something. I have an interesting, I want to tell you about the timeline of things. I don't know if that's interesting or not.
I don't know. Well, it always changes too. Like sometimes we're recording this way ahead and
I don't know if it's interesting or not. It's just something I'm realizing I always want to bring up to this section, but it should be neat. So give people a little background on how Rebecca came to be today's guest, because that's unique.
Yeah, so she sought me out as a doula, and unfortunately she's due during a time that I will not be here in LA, so I could not take her on as a client. But I felt really, I don't know, just something in me was like, meet this woman, you know, just like extend some antepartum doula knowledge onto her and enjoy, like, you know, I'm just interested in people's pregnancy journeys.
Sure.
So we met for a tea, and not very far into our tea, she was like, oh, I have some, I found out some medical information, you know, are you interested in hearing about it that'll affect my labor and delivery?
Mm-hmm.
She's like, I have a very, you probably don't know what it is. It's factor 11 deficiency, hemophilia C. And I was like, okay, this is why I was supposed to come today and meet you.
Yeah.
So it was very exciting. I mean, it's not exciting that she has a bleeding disorder,
right,
but it was exciting that my two worlds collide.
Yeah. And I'm sure for her, you know, thinking that she's coming to meet a doula, she's certainly looking for, you know, information about her labor and delivery process. But I can't imagine she thought she's going to get anywhere close to somebody this connected to the hemophilia bleeding disorder component.
Probably
of it
not.
All.
No. And it was exciting. It was exciting to, you know, unfortunately I can't help her in the doula capacity, but I was like, would you like to be on my podcast?
So that's what we're doing. So today we're going to talk to her about that experience of through pregnancy, learning what it is to both have and be carrying a bleeding disorder. And how does that alter your thinking about labor and delivery, family planning? Like, how does that, it's, unusual that we're kind of catching someone just around the time that they learn that information.
Yeah.
So a unique opportunity to get a perspective that isn't necessarily easy to come by. We also had bleeding disorders come up in another weird way recently of equal importance, which is during our binging of Netflix's The Staircase documentary about the Peterson trial for murdering his wife, the murderer, suspect, or what are we supposed to say? Because I guess
we don't want to give away.
That's true. It's a complicated twisty-turny series. But at like 6 episodes in, they're just all of a sudden someone's like, well, so-and-so, I mean, and she had a bleeding disorder. And it was
both
one of those moments where it's like, what? What am I watching again? What is this?
But then they didn't even go into it. You would think that, you know,
because it was brought up in the context of like this person bled out and they had a bleeding disorder. That's probably relevant information. And it's like, yeah, you're right. That is relevant information. You should talk more about that. And then they never came back to it. 13 episodes of that thing. And they didn't come back to the bleeding disorder. But
and it was never in the trial, which is also just an interesting.
Well, it was never presented as being in the trial. True. I don't know if it actually made it in or not. But yeah, Elizabeth Ratliff, who died in Germany, probably was murdered, had von Willebrand disease. And that came up in this in The Staircase, which is a very popular show on Netflix. So that's a lot like what you just shared, meeting Rebecca and learning happenstancely that she so happened to be connected to this bleeding disorders thing. It's like the same.
Totally the same. Yeah. You know, when we're watching our nighttime TV programs and, you know, not thinking about bleeding disorders or anything related. And then they're like, well, she had a bleeding disorder. And I was like, what? Huh?
Cannot compute too late in the night.
Anyways, really interesting.
And then one last quick shout out to everybody who's participated in the A Kick for Hemophilia campaign that was started by Megan Adideron and Hemophilia Foundation of Nigeria to try to use the World Cup and the attention on soccer to make the point that most people born with hemophilia around the world will never have the chance to kick a soccer ball in any kind of competitive way, no less. Imagine playing in the World Cup. So she created this campaign of people kicking soccer balls to raise a little bit of awareness about that reality around the world. So Natalie and I were happy to participate in that along with a number of our friends from the community. Kudos to Megan for making that happen and using the opportunity to spread a little bit of awareness. Reminder that if you haven't already, you should be subscribing to the Bloodstream podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to us. Reminder to all of our listeners, if you are not already, to subscribe to us on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, Stitcher. You will find the Bloodstream podcast on all the go-to spots for downloading podcasts. Subscribing to us will give you the most recent episode directly into your podcast feed. And we also ask you to share the pod with friends. We have found that one of the best ways to reach new listeners for all podcasts in general, and certainly for this one, is through recommendation and word of mouth. So if you have found these episodes to be interesting, entertaining, I hope they're mildly entertaining, I will try to tell better stories and talk about things other than just what time we're recording this to make you laugh a little bit. But we do try to make this entertaining and educational. And if you think that it is accomplishing those, share that with friends who you think could benefit from it. And again, a reminder that you can connect with Bloodstream Media, the umbrella company for all of our podcasts here, on Facebook, facebook.com/Bloodstream Media, on Twitter @BloodstreamInfo, or you can email us at mailbag@BloodstreamMedia.com. Now, on last month's episode, we did away with our community news in 60 seconds game because basically the episode was a fleshed out community news. Well, not the episode, but we spent a lot of time on WFH updates. So we got rid of the community news in 60 seconds game. It is back for this month. And as always, just before we record community news in 60 seconds, Natalie has the look of a terrified deer running through the wilderness with no sense of destination in sight. Are you do you feel ready to do community news in 60 seconds today?
The thousands of emails we got missing it last month. I'm doing it for everyone.
All right, wait, I have to get a really horrific sound going here. What's this? No, that's a nice sound.
That is nice.
We don't need that. That's like someone's calling. We don't need that one. Let's go to classic. Why would we want to do that? There we go.
That's the worst sound. One.
Okay, so when that one goes off, that's how we know that community news in 60 seconds has ended. But before it ends, it must begin. And Natalie Rose, are you ready for this to begin?
As ready as I'll ever be.
Community news in 60 seconds, a game that is exactly what it sounds like, starts Now,
two new papers have been released that suggest that cells have been successfully added using CRISPR technology may have a higher likelihood of triggering cancer. Even if the research findings are confirmed, the problem doesn't affect every form of CRISPR gene editing, only one particular method.
There we go. Hemophilia patients who develop inhibitors against treatment face markedly higher healthcare costs, about three times those of other patients, and experience poorer quality of life, according to a team of scientists in Italy.
Octa Pharma announced the launch of Canadian Prevail, immune tolerance induction in hemophilia A patients using Willate study for patients with hemophilia A.
uniQure has enrolled the first patient in its Phase 3 HOPE-B single-dose trial investigating the effectiveness and safety of AMT-061 in treating people with severe or moderately severe hemophilia B.
NHS England has approved the reimbursement of Hemlibra for the prevention of bleeding episodes.
10 seconds left. Shire announced the Committee for Medicinal Products for Human Use of the European Medicines Agency has issued a positive opinion recommending the granting of marketing authorization in the European Union for Von Vendi for adults with von Willebrand disease when...
Okay. Yep.
Yeah. All right. I mean, that was okay. That was okay.
I think we could do better.
I think we could do better, too.
I felt jumbled.
Here's the thing. No one needs us to say those six things again.
No.
No one needs it. There were some good keywords if you needed to hear some news.
Basically, just go to the program notes if you want your news.
Correct. One minor correction to the community news in 60 seconds race through. I believe I had mentioned that Von Vendi had been approved or had gotten a positive opinion by the European Medicines Agency, but it is Vevondi, I believe, is the name of the product over there. So it's Shire's von Willebrand disease medication that we in the U.S. know as Von Vendi. There it is, Vevondi, I suppose. I guess there was some real big important reason it couldn't have the same name.
I'm so sure some kind of trademark
something
situation.
Real vital. So we got to have just a little bit of confusion mixed in.
Tomato, tomato.
Von Vendi et Vevondi. So yeah, there's that. Correction to community news in 60 seconds. Now for our July episode like segment, this story that we lifted specifically from ABC on a step therapy bill that is headed to the Rhode Island State House. What does that mean and how is that relevant for our community? Here to present that story and those answers is Natalie Rose. Natalie, take it away.
So I didn't know much about step therapy before reading this article, but it's really interesting and definitely affects people with all kinds of chronic illness. Step therapy, also known as fail first, requires patients who are prescribed expensive medications by their doctors to take and fail on the cheaper medications first, which sounds like a lot of unnecessary, you're basically just testing on people, like, try this. Oh, it didn't work? Okay, now we'll let you try the expensive one.
It's hard to argue that it's a patient-friendly protocol.
No, it sounds insurance-friendly. But yeah, only after that will health insurance providers cover the more expensive drug. So you got to fail a bunch before they're like, okay, we'll pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
So currently in Rhode Island, a bill aimed at changing the use of step therapy has passed the Senate and is headed to the House, which is exciting. The bill under consideration at the House wouldn't stop the ban, wouldn't ban step therapy,
okay,
but it would make it easier for doctors to override the step therapy process in certain cases, which I assume might more likely pass if it's not a strict ban,
right,
but allows doctors to make... to have discretionary,
to use their expertise to make a determination as to whether or not that's actually the best protocol. It's not just instantaneously the protocol. It's that if the doctor, I guess it's instantaneously the protocol and the doctor is empowered to override it.
Yeah.
Right? That's what the bill proposes, more or less?
Yeah. And I think that's, for our community, very important because, you know, you want a treatment that is effective for you. And if it is the most expensive treatment, like, you know, you don't want to have to fool around with a bunch of other ones to find one that works for you. So interestingly enough, I was doing a little research online about step therapy in general. Mm-hmm. And because this doesn't just affect hemophilia, it affects a lot of chronic conditions. The National Psoriasis Foundation has a website about step therapy legislation by state. And there's a cool map of the United States.
It is a cool map. I've seen it. It's a cool map.
But yeah, you can click on it and it either tells you what the legislation is in your state or if you're currently a target state. And if you are a current target state, it means that they are working on legislation and that you can write in to your legislators and tell them what you want. So we'll include that in the program notes, but it's really interesting. And
that ties well too in the most recent HemaWare from NHF. There was an article on the power of state level advocacy and making the point that often federal efforts and national efforts can get a little more spotlight or attention, but why state level efforts are as if not arguably more important. And there's five examples from Ohio, South Carolina, New York, two other places I'm blanking on off the top of my head. But just pointing out specific areas of state level advocacy. I think actually in New York that Bob Graham is quoted in talking about, he's a big activist in the bleeding disorders community in upstate New York, and is talking about the step therapy bills and challenges of the last few years in New York specifically. But it just kind of, it goes hand in hand with that NHF article emphasizing the importance of state level advocacy, not just federal advocacy. Just wanted to make that point as well.
Well, and that state level advocacy leads to federal advocacy. And even on steptherapy.com, it's saying U.S. Congress is taking action as well due to the success at the state level.
Yeah. So that's great. So yeah, like you said, we'll have the links in the program notes if you want to learn more about step therapy in your state, just to know what's going on in your state, even if it's not necessarily something that you expect will interact with your life soon. Good to know what's going on in your state, and you might find yourself inclined to want to get involved. Thanks, Natalie.
You're welcome.
And now for this month's share segment, it comes to us from community member Lydia Ruiz, who has von Willebrand disease, and shares a bit about her journey toward getting a diagnosis and how it's impacted some of the ways that she thinks about her life and people she engages with. And, you know, she's going to say it a lot better than I can. So we'll just let Lydia take stage here in a moment, but not before I give a quick shout out where it's due to our sponsor, Shire. Shire has made the Bloodstream podcast possible now for 26 episodes, committing to this form of digital media communication as a means of education and empowerment for our community. So as always, I am grateful and would like to say to the folks at Shire, thank you, Shire. All right, take it away, Lydia Ruiz.
An unexpected blessing. My name is Lydia Grande Ruiz. I am 24 years old and I have moderate von Willebrand disease type 2M. I was diagnosed a month before my high school graduation, but I began to show symptoms in middle school. I was bleeding a lot, going through four pads every hour, so right away my mom made an appointment with my doctor. She told us that it was perfectly normal. Most girls experience that and it will go away on its own. I also have epilepsy and have dealt with many doctors telling me it was nothing before being diagnosed, so I was skeptical. But as the years went by, the heavy bleeding subsided, and it seemed like she had been right. Unfortunately, peace does not last forever. In the final months of my junior year, I did not have my period for 4 months. When I got it, it was as bad as it had been in middle school, along with the side effects of being tired, bruising easily, and loss of appetite. After blood transfusions, hospitalizations, numerous doctor's appointments, and blood tests, I was finally diagnosed with VWD in May 2012. Being diagnosed was such a huge relief, but fear was at the back of my mind. From the beginning, I was always paranoid about what guy would like me with my condition and not see me as someone fragile who could bleed to death from a paper cut. My mom understood where I was coming from, and she told me that the right guy would understand and still care for me, but at the same time, let me be independent. I hope she was right. When I told my first boyfriend about it, he was curious. He had never heard of VWD and always saw me wearing my medical ID bracelet. I informed him all about my bleeding disorder and debunked the myths surrounding VWD. I told him that there are days where I want to stay in bed because my joint pains get bad, and at first he understood. But as time went by, things got difficult. He would treat me as a regular person, which I appreciated, but at the same time, it got annoying because he would forget I have a bleeding disorder. I got tired of telling him over and over again that I am just tired and it does not mean anything personal. Eventually, we broke up because it was stressful and we both had a busy schedule. When I told my current boyfriend about my bleeding disorder, He told me that he appreciates me opening up to him and that he still sees me as a strong woman. When I get joint pain so bad that I cannot get out of bed, he brings ice packs and massages my joints. I have always been ashamed to ask for help for anything or even take a rest day when my joint pain is unbearable. But being with my boyfriend, I have learned to listen to my body more and ask for help. He has opened my eyes to the fact that we should never be ashamed to ask for what we need. In unexpected ways, having Von Willebrand has been the best thing that has ever happened to me. It has helped me find true friends who understand and look out for me. It has also allowed me to find a partner who is beyond amazing and has crumbled my fear of being rejected because of my bleeding disorder. My boyfriend is my best friend, and I am beyond blessed to have him and my amazing friends in my life. I am currently working towards my associate's degree in film production at Santa Monica College. I hope to one day use my major to shed light on bleeding disorders and become an advocate for this incredible community.
So, Natalie, we were just talking a little bit, but share on mic what you're just sharing after listening to Lydia's piece.
Well, it's just interesting to hear, you know, her doctor saying like, oh, this is just like a period of time where you're going to be a heavy bleeder, or, mm-hmm. you know, like that's what it is to be a lady with a period.
Yeah.
But yeah, like 14 to 17, I bled like crazy. Like I would go through, you know, she's saying 4 pads an hour. Like I remember there were periods where I had that experience too, and I don't have a bleeding disorder. So I think it is complicated, and the diagnosis of VWD, you know, the symptoms of like what could be a bleeding disorder, but also just could be like normal.
Stacy Croteau, actually, hematologist, and I think the medical director at, it's one of the Massachusetts HTCs, maybe Boston Children's, I don't remember off the top of my head, but she was one of our powering through panelists, and I was on my soapbox at some point during that panel about if you or a woman you know has experienced heavy, prolonged periods on a consistent basis, you or that person may have a bleeding disorder. Get to, like I was doing my little PSA thing. And Stacy chimed in, or I should say Dr. Croteau chimed in, and I made the point that menorrhagia or heavy menstrual bleeds are not necessarily indicative of a bleeding disorder. Those are also symptoms of a whole slew of other diagnoses as well.
Yeah. I mean, endometriosis or there's a bunch of other things, or just like high hormone levels. Like I think from 14 to 17, my hormones were very different than they are now, or even in college or in my 20s. But yeah, for 3 years, like I would have been considered an incredibly heavy bleeder who passed a lot of clots, who, you know.
And I might argue that someone like you in those scenarios, when you go to your OB to talk about it, like should you be tested for Von Willebrand disease? Should part of certain indicators, even in teenage girls with hormones who are evolving, should we automatically be testing for a bleeding disorder? What are we waiting for? Are we waiting for that 4-year period to go on for 5 or 6 years? Like your story and your sharing that, it underscores that this is complicated, because it's not as though it's one equals the next. It's not you have heavy menstrual bleeds, you have a bleeding disorder. It doesn't work that easily. But it is a profound symptom and one of the most recognizable and life-altering. So I think part of the problem is, and it'll be interesting to see, and we'll talk about this actually in a moment with the VWD diagnosis guidelines that are being developed. What's the point at which we are, as a practice, getting curious about investigating for a diagnosis, as opposed to saying, yeah, well, you know, your body's changing. Like that can be true, but also you could have a disorder.
Yeah.
You know,
well, and you know, what's been brought up before is like, I'm apt to say, like, if I had a daughter who was in their mid teens, bleeding a lot, having clots, experiencing what I experienced, I would be like, you know, say very similar things, like, you know, we're just heavy bleeders.
Yep.
And that's true for me in that period of my life. And then like now I'm not. So, you know, I don't think I have a bleeding disorder.
Right.
And would not probably like get curious about my daughter in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's complex. It's interesting. So thank you, Lydia. Your sharing has it started some conversation here. I also wanted to point out too, and I think we've talked about this on Bloodstream before as well. Lydia is certainly not the first, won't be the last, to refer to her bleeding disorder in some way as a blessing or a gift or something that has this like overly positive connotation. And I have heard and respect the voices of those who say, I don't need the severe joint damage. I don't need the co-infections. I don't need all the replacement limb surgeries to teach me how to be or whatever. And like, fair enough, point taken. But I think when Lydia said it and what she said, it really speaks to having a perspective. It's not the bleeding disorder. It's the fact that the bleeding disorder leads to an evolution in who you are as a person, can lead to an evolution in who you are as a person at a younger age, help you develop a perspective, help you prioritize what really matters when you're thinking about a partner, what you look for in a partner, what you look for out of a career. Natalie, incredibly unprofessional. I'm trying to make a big point about perspective and our technology is going
on. I'm sorry.
That's all you got? Unbelievable. But
no, but it is. I also think you develop a better relationship to self-care and what that means.
Yes, good point.
A greater sense.
And there's gratitude that can come with being aware of your practice in that regard. So there are these beneficial outcomes or beneficial silver linings. Yeah. That I think lead to a sentiment of this is a gift. This is something good. Obviously, clinically, biologically, it is something detrimental. But the outcomes can be good if you choose to recognize and optimize the gifts that it does present you with, the opportunities for perspective, the opportunities for appreciating priorities in life, appreciating self-care, appreciating good health, appreciating advocacy, appreciating the way policy impacts advocacy, and all this stuff. So I just wanted to make that point as well. So again, thank you, Lydia. And you can read her An Unexpected Blessing story in blog form if you go to bloodstreampod.com/blog. Now rounding out the like, share, comment segments for this month, our comment segment is on a recent announcement about some developments affecting people with and affected by von Willebrand disease. So in June, the American Society of Hematology, or ASH, I always think of all the acronyms, like ASH is just like cool.
Yeah.
Right? Like that's
it
a good one.
Cool.
Yeah. It's way better than...
I mean, it's a word.
It's a word. Yeah, we don't actually have a lot of word acronyms. There's just a lot of like NHF, HFA, WFH, BABA-D, IST.
Yeah, and then there's ASH.
And there's ASH. Well, ASH, they announced that they will be collaborating with the International Society on Thrombosis and Hemostasis, that is ISTH, the National Hemophilia Foundation, NHF, and the World Federation of Hemophilia, WFH, as well as the University of Kansas Medical Center, to develop clinical practice guidelines on the diagnosis and management of von Willebrand disease. So this is significant for a couple of reasons, not the least of which is that it's the first time ASH, ISTH, NHF, and the WFH have collaborated on clinical practice guidelines of any kind. And knowing that von Willebrand disease is the most common bleeding disorder in the world, as many as 90% of people with it are not diagnosed, there are certainly steps to be taken in how we diagnose and then subsequently manage people with VWD. So good to see these four preeminent organizations working in consensus to develop what those practices look like. So by way of background, I know most people listening will know this, but just to be explicit, von Willebrand disease is the most common bleeding disorder. It affects approximately 1%. Of the world's population. That's a lot of people, 1% of the world's population. This inherited condition results in the decreased production, absence, or abnormal function of the clotting protein von Willebrand factor. VWD, von Willebrand disease, can cause unusual bleeding from small wounds or minor procedures, frequent nosebleeds, bruising, bleeding in joints, and heavy menstrual bleeds. Symptoms may vary from patient to patient or in a single patient over the course of his or her life. That was something that was particularly striking to me when we were working on our Bloodline podcast series, the special Bloodline series, VWD Diagnosis, Management, and Life. We interviewed a slew of people with VWD, caretakers, clinicians from all over the world, and the variation from person to person just through the course of their own story is tremendous, never mind when compared to other people with theoretically the same diagnosis. If you haven't listened to that and you have VWD or a loved one with VWD, tell you what, give me 5 minutes. Listen to the first 5 minutes of the first episode. And if you dig it, there's 85 more minutes across three episodes that I think you're going to like. So go to bloodstreammedia.com and click the link to the Bloodline series, and you'll see VWD Diagnosis Management and Life there. Back to background, primary care providers, pediatricians, obstetricians, and gynecologists who observe unusual bleeding often refer these patients to a hematologist for further testing and management. That's one of the lines from ASH. I think that's the hope. I don't know if that is often actually the case. Many patients with mild symptoms do not receive a diagnosis right away and live for many years with untreated bleeding. We know that to be the case. The goal of this effort between these four organizations, along with the Kansas Medical Center, in developing these practices and these guidelines is to create and maintain state-of-the-art guidelines on VWD so that we have one preeminent book of guidelines that can be used as a basis for all conversation on the treatment and management of patients with VWD. There will be two expert panels who will produce recommendations for diagnosis and management. The panels are made up of more than 20 individuals, including U.S.-based and international hematologists, patients with VWD, and scientists with expertise in evidence synthesis and appraisal and guideline development methodology. Sounds fancy. Panel members will identify and prioritize guideline questions based on the frequency with which a question arises in clinical practice, the degree to which there is variation in clinical practice, the extent to which the question has already been addressed by high-quality guidelines, fair enough, don't need to reinvent the wheel, and implications for resource utilization. Informing the questions, the panel will also place high importance on areas in which development of guidelines could improve care and health outcomes important to patients and their caregivers. So, great, all well and good. What does that mean for you? Well, two things. If you are a person with or a caregiver of a person with von Willebrand disease, NHF announced earlier this month, so a couple weeks after this initial announcement, that there is a stakeholder survey that they created to help in determining the key topics to include in these guidelines. So it's a two-page survey. It should take about 10 to 15 minutes to complete, and it is an excellent opportunity for you to voice what you believe to be the priority topics related to the diagnosis and management of VWD. Get your voice in there. Follow the links in the program notes to the survey disseminated by NHF. And then the second thing that this means, again, as many as 9 out of 10 people with VWD are not diagnosed. 1% of the population and as many as 9 out of 10 of them are not diagnosed. So if you know someone who experiences being told that they have low iron and being treated for anemia but not seeing progress in their health, if you know someone who's experienced heavy bleeding after any surgery, including dental surgery, someone who has experienced heavy menstrual bleeding, having to change a pad or a tampon every hour, that's often used as a guideline for heavy bleeding that could potentially be indicative of a bleeding disorder. If you know someone who's experienced heavy bleeding after childbirth or miscarriage, if you know someone who experiences frequent nosebleeds that last longer than 10 minutes, if you know someone who has bleeding from cuts or injuries that lasts longer than 10 minutes, if you know somebody who bruises easily with bruises that are raised and larger than a quarter, if you know someone in your family who has one or more of these symptoms, or if you know someone in your family who has been diagnosed with a bleeding disorder, such as VWD or hemophilia, you want that individual to be curious. BetterYouKnow.org is a website for men and women who may experience symptoms of a bleeding disorder but have not been diagnosed. With this site, NHF is trying to raise awareness and knowledge of bleeding disorders as part of a larger Better You Know campaign, but you'll also find risk assessment tools and other information to learn whether or not you are at risk for a bleeding disorder and need to take some next steps in the clinical setting. So learn more and empower yourself or someone you know or love by visiting betteryouknow.org. So again, to recap, two things you can do about this news related to VWD guidelines being developed. One, if you want to get your voice in there, take that survey, link in the program notes. Two, make sure if you know a family, friend, loved one, neighbor, somebody who you just somehow know about their bleeding patterns and they have these symptoms that are consistent with a bleeding disorder, please encourage them to go to betteryouknow.org to learn more about whether or not they do indeed have a bleeding disorder. Thus concludes this month's comment segment. So Natalie, getting into today's interview segment with Rebecca, tell us who Rebecca is. How did you meet her? Why is she here? What's the story?
So Rebecca is originally from New York. She lives here in Los Angeles now. She works as a yoga teacher at Love Yoga here in LA, and that studio is owned by a dear friend of mine. So when Rebecca was pregnant, studio owner suggested that I be her doula. So Rebecca called me for an interview, and her due date I have some conflicts with, but I met with her anyways to talk about her pregnancy journey and found out that she had hemophilia C. So it was like two of my worlds colliding, and led to an amazing discussion, and then me asking her to join us today on the podcast.
It's unusual to have an opportunity to talk to somebody who, as Rebecca will talk about in a little bit, through the process of this pregnancy has learned that she has hemophilia C, that she may be carrying it, and some other things as well. But for our relevance, hemophilia C or factor E11 deficiency. So often we hear about diagnosis stories in retrospect. We hear about the story of a mom bringing a kid in to the world and learning about their condition in retrospect. And Rebecca's in process. So it's kind of an interesting, unique opportunity to talk to somebody in process of this life event about what does it mean to your identity? What does it mean to your birth plan? What does it mean to your health? What does it mean for the relationship to your partner and the way your family planning is going. So really cool, a really cool find, Natalie.
Thanks.
So should we get to it?
Yeah.
All right, here it is, our conversation and interview with Rebecca Haber.
We are here with Rebecca Haber. Hi, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
Good. As I had mentioned earlier in the podcast, Rebecca and I had met, she was looking for a doula, and unfortunately I am not available to be her doula, but I did feel compelled to meet with her, and I feel like the reason was because during our meeting I found out that she has hemophilia C. So, we're just here to chat about that. It's a very interesting.
And I should add too, though, that she found out she has hemophilia C through this pregnancy. It wasn't something she was aware of prior to this. The process of being pregnant revealed this, kind of an interesting, specific wrinkle to Rebecca's story.
Actually, I found out before we got pregnant because we did some genetic testing to sort of see what, if we were gonna have to
anything to look out for.
Yeah, anything to look out for, because I'm the Ashkenazi Jew lineage, and apparently we have a lot of issues. So, so they recommended doing the Ashkenazi panel. So that's how we found out.
Okay, cool. And that was my first question, to see what prompted the genetic testing pre-pregnancy and
being a Jew.
All right.
So is that pretty common within Ashkenazi Jews specifically to do this kind of genetic testing to just rule out or discover things to be aware of?
I think anytime you go in for any sort of fertility treatment, one of the first things they do is do basic genetic testing, and they ask you your background a little bit. And then once you say Ashkenazi, they're like, red flag. So I think it's just like one of the first steps in fertility treatment generally. Mm-hmm. So that was what happened.
And is there any known history of bleeding disorders in your family?
No. So I actually had 14 of the disorders come back that I'm either a carrier or have a mild condition. And my family has no idea. They had no idea that we had any of this stuff. It's definitely overwhelming to get the printout back in my email and, see that I had 14 of these things red,
Yeah. So.
And your immediate reaction surrounding the diagnosis of hemophilia C. So your family was shocked, and you were shocked to get the 14 red flags. But did you have any, this being something that could affect your pregnancy and labor and delivery? What was your immediate reaction?
This was one of the less concerning ones for me in terms of immediate reaction, because I'm also a carrier for something called Fragile X syndrome. And in terms of reproducing, that was definitely the more concerning thing. So I think a lot of our attention went there initially. I also have another weird bleeding disorder that's called, I think it's called prothrombin thrombophilia, which is the opposite problem. It's you guys probably know, it's you're more prone to blood clots. So they were well, you're a medical anomaly.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. You've got one where you can't clot and one where you might clot too much. So I don't know. So I guess that was my general reaction. It was just great. you know.
And has this knowledge of both bleeding disorders changed any of your considerations during this pregnancy or thinking about the labor and delivery?
Yeah. So the prothrombin thrombophilia was nerve-wracking at the beginning because, you know, you're more prone to blood clots when you're pregnant. The factor 11 deficiency with labor approaching has been a little bit of an issue, and I've had to go see a hematologist and have blood work done and, you know, try to figure out a contingency plan. And so that has been a little bit stressful as well. Yeah.
And then specifically when thinking about labor and delivery, are there any kind of preparations you're doing or things you have to think about to prepare with this new diagnosis?
Yeah. So it's been a little bit complicated, and I'm still not 100% sure what I'm going to decide to do moving forward. But basically, it's always a risk to get an epidural because if they get too close to the spinal column, you can have spinal bleeding. And with a bleeding condition, if they can't stop the spinal bleeding, it can lead to paralysis or neurological damage. So for factor 11 deficiency, they don't have the factors isolated, as you guys know. So that means the preemptive treatment is just getting a ton of fresh plasma transfusions. So, you know, there's always a little bit of a risk involved. So I've really had to decide, like, do I want to go for that? Or do I want to go for a natural, unmedicated childbirth? God forbid, you know, something went wrong and I had to have an emergency C-section, they wouldn't be able to give me the spinal tap. They would have to put me under, and then I would miss the birth of my child if I didn't have the plasma preemptively. So
are you currently in a position where you know what the options are, you know what each would entail, and it's a matter of sitting with it and thinking it through and talking it through and just letting some time go by? Or are you waiting on a few other pieces of information to help you determine whether or not proactively getting plasma or not is going to be the move for you?
I think we have pretty much all of the information. The only thing I think that we're sort of waiting to see is if we can, because the reason that you have to decide preemptively if you want the plasma is because it takes a couple of hours for them to find the match in the hospital and then get it brought up to where you're at, because the infusion itself only takes about 30-45 minutes. So, you know, if it's like a real emergency situation, which is rare, then there wouldn't be enough time for that. But if they knew that the whole situation was heading towards a C-section and they had an hour, like, you know, if they had the blood up there already, that would be great. So what we're trying to find out is there a way to get the blood up there preemptively so that there's the option to use it if I want, or would I have to, you know, decide that I want it and then have it brought up and have it take like 3 hours to get it up there once I decide. So, because really what I would like to do is to not decide to play the whole thing by ear. So I guess we're just trying to figure out if that's going to be an option.
And I have to, you had mentioned before we started recording that your doula was talking and saying that it might not be to push a little on the plasma can't be made available component.
Yeah, and right.
That, my kind of advocacy ears go up at that too. Like, it doesn't make logical sense to me that plasma can't be on standby ready to go in the event of, but not necessarily taken proactively. It doesn't like logistically, I just don't understand why that couldn't be executed. It might be unusual. They might not be used to it, but it doesn't mean that it can't necessarily be executed.
Yeah. I mean, that was a question that I asked my obstetrician sort of a couple weeks ago, and she led me to believe like, yeah, you can't really do that. But then our doula, yeah, raised the question like, well, you know, she's not at the hospital. Like, she's got her own private practice. So like, maybe you should call the hospital because they're the ones who are actually going to be dealing with this anyway. So that's kind of our next plan of action.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tricky knowing like what department or hospital or entity, like whom are you supposed to speak to about what parts of certain processes. And that's something that living with a rare condition I have found to be a frustration, is that you're kind of always having to be in a position of being the educator for every system, for every individual that you talk to. And then it becomes hard to figure out where you actually need to go to get to the end result that you need.
And you like really have to be your own advocate. I mean, that's definitely been made more clear to me as I've had more situations kind of go awry in the last year or so.
Do you feel like there's cohesiveness between your care team, between the hematologist and your OBGYN, or that you're the one who's carrying the communication?
What's been really interesting is that everyone has not wanted to make any sort of decision or not wanted to advise me in any specific way. So like, they're all sort of like, oh, you know, this is the situation. These are your options. You should meet with the anesthesiologist and they'll tell you what to do. Then I go to the anesthesiologist and they're like, so what did your obstetrician say? And I'm like, she said you would have all the answers. And they literally go, ha, we don't.
For this process that you've never participated in before with a condition that you just found out about.
Right.
Yes.
So who does exactly?
Right. Exactly.
I don't. I know I don't. So you tell me who does.
Right.
I also think specifically with labor, it's not like you know you're going in July 20th. So making sure that that plasma, like that the person you talk to who's like, yeah, no problem, like that that's well communicated and well documented, and that like someone who maybe hasn't executed that before is there on that day and is like, oh, we don't do that. And it's like, well, no, this person said you do, and make it happen. So like, I think, you know, if it was, I know I'm going in for a procedure on the 20th, to make sure that those things are lined up, but...
That is a little bit trickier. The level of, you need a higher degree of confidence that whatever has been agreed upon is implemented and communicated appropriately.
Also, with hemophilia being hereditary, have you tested the baby for hemophilia?
We have not. Ultimately, it wouldn't have affected the outcome of the pregnancy.
Great. Well, is there anything that you... would like to talk about in regards to like fears or concerns or things you're wondering about having a bleeding disorder and embarking on your first labor and delivery?
I mean, the other thing I'm concerned about is if I do decide to have the plasma transfusions, that I'm going to be less likely to follow through with having a natural unmedicated childbirth, because I'll be like, well, I don't want to have to, you know, have had this transfusion in vain, so I might as well get the epidural, right? So that's sort of like an interesting conundrum. But yeah, I'm also just very interested to see if I don't have the transfusions, do I have any bleeding problems? Because a lot of people, as my hematologist told me, have like, you know, a lower percentage of this factor or clotting factor and never exhibit symptoms. And then some people have, their numbers are fine and then they do have symptoms. So I'm like, well, then why do you test at all, right?
It's frustrating. That is, yeah. That's true to different degrees across the various forms of hemophilia, and even more true in von Willebrand disease, which is also a bleeding disorder. It's not missing factor proteins along the clotting cascade, but it's deficiencies in another element of the overall clotting and healing process. But same is true there. Two people can be diagnosed as type 1 von Willebrand disease and have completely different symptomatic expressions. Mm-hmm. So not only is it extremely hard to get a diagnosis, then once you get it, how it compares to other people with the diagnosis is quite different. And then even within your own experience, how it may vary is quite different. So that's something that it's true within hemophilia, but it's some of the work that we did within von Willebrand disease, I came to really appreciate the wide array of actual experiences with the disorder. So yeah, on one hand, it's great that we can at least say type 1, type 2, type 3, subset A, type 2M, whatever. But then also acknowledging that that is not a be-all, end-all of understanding what that person has and is experiencing because of how varied it truly is when you get beyond just the name and the label.
Was it your plan to do an unmedicated birth? Like, has that been your desire before your hemophilia diagnosis?
It was originally like, I'm going to go as far as I can without getting the epidural, but if I need it, I'm not going to allow myself to feel guilty or bad about it or anything like that. So I guess the reason that the decision is with the plasma is so hard is because it takes that option out of the equation. Like, I have to pre-decide. But yeah, my intention was to attempt to go unmedicated.
Have there been any conversations with other women that have influenced the way you're thinking about medicated, unmedicated, in general, with the hemophilia C notwithstanding, just writ large, I'm curious?
Well, one of the nurses at Cedars-Sinai said something that really resonated with both of us, I think, which was, you know, labor pain isn't like stubbing your toe and then being like freaked out that you broke something and like having that sort of sharp pain followed by fear and the unknown. It's productive pain. And so like, if you can think of it like that, that your body's actually working towards something and there is an end goal in sight and then it's going to be over, it makes it more manageable. So yeah, I've definitely heard a bunch of stuff that's affected, I think, the way that I've thought about going unmedicated. And
was the result, did at any point looking at those results, Was there a conversation about, do we want to go through with this?
We were under the impression that we were going to have trouble getting pregnant. And we actually weren't planning on getting pregnant anytime soon. We just, I went into my gynecologist for like a completely unrelated reason. She happened to do hormone testing and was like, oh, you might be going into premature ovarian failure. So if you want to have kids ever, you might want to consider freezing your eggs. And so I actually got into this whole fertility thing because I was planning to freeze embryos with my husband so that we could like wait to have children. So when we found out that I had all of these things, we were thinking we were freezing embryos and that we could actually test the embryos before we decided to use them. So that never really came into the equation. But then we like sort of got fed up with the whole process and realized that we were probably just in denial about being in our mid-30s and that we should just try naturally to have a kid and see if we even like need to go through this whole IVF process. And then we got pregnant very easily, as it turned out. So when we decided to start trying naturally, I guess I had talked enough already with the geneticists, pretty much made it clear that the chances of the baby having something life-threatening or like that would really affect the quality of their life was so like something like 1 in 100 million or something based on my results. So,
and also you've made it to your mid-30s with conditions that you didn't even know you had, and you know, seems like you've had a pretty nice life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Was there any kind of identity shift in that? Because I know for some people, they hear about a condition, how even it, whether or not the condition has actually, you know, for some, the diagnosis kind of comes with a sense of relief because like, oh, that's why I get those nosebleeds that don't stop for 20 minutes at a time every couple months. That's why this, that's why that. So it at least kind of fills in blanks and gives a sense of relief, rounds out a sense of identity. There's like some positive like self-optics associated with a diagnosis. But it sounds like it, I'm gathering, maybe I'm putting this on you, but I'm gathering that for you, it was more like, okay, this is information, but didn't necessarily like affect your core or your identity in any way. Or maybe it did. I don't know.
No, it did a little bit. I mean, you know, I'm like a paranoid New York Jew who like always thinks I'm dying. So like, you know, so to get like this list of red flags, I was like, oh my God, I'm like,
well, it's happening. It is happening.
Yeah. Yeah. Confirmed. Yeah. My fears and my suspicions are confirmed. I don't know. Like you feel like an odd sense of guilt that like you have all these like things wrong with you and that like you could potentially pass them on or like dirty your spouse's perfect gene pool.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, those are real things people speak to. I hear it all the time. Like those are very real experiences people have. Like what did your family have to say about whatever you may have shared with them about the results of the tests, hemophilia and otherwise?
My parents got tested to see which one of them was the carrier of Fragile X because it kind of matters male, female, like who passed it on. Mm. But then they actually didn't get tested for anything else because they were like, well, we've made it this long. We don't want to know.
And for you, was that fine? Like that's who they are and fine. Did you need anything more from them or were you looking for more when you shared with them or a little more, curiosity perhaps?
No, I mean, they're their own people and they need to handle the information the way that they want to handle it. I mean, that's not the choice that I would make. Like, I'm the type of person, I want to know like everything. Like, I want to know all the information. If I have some disorder, like I want to know where it came from and, you know, what are the potential consequences? And they're like, not those people. So like, right. What are you going to do?
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah. And do you have siblings?
I do. Yeah. I have a brother who... has not been tested, but I don't think, it's impossible for him to have the Fragile X because it came from my father and it's only on the X chromosome.
Okay.
So he got the Y from my father, obviously. So he doesn't have that one. And that was really, in terms of procreating, that was really the only concern. So he's not getting tested.
Yeah, you took care of that for him, I guess,
yeah,
in that regard.
He did find out recently that he has a mild congenital heart condition that we never knew about, but that was not through genetic testing. That was because he like had like a really little heart murmur that his doctor heard, and then he had an EKG, and then they found this like really subtle defect in his heart. But He's lived, you know, 36 years without ever knowing about it, but right. that's something he could potentially pass on.
And does he have children or planning to?
He's married and they're planning to have children, but I don't know when. So maybe maybe when it comes time he'll I don't know, have the fetus tested. I have no idea.
Right, like whatever the protocol is there.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. Okay. It's just interesting to track through families where, you know, both like from a biological point of view, but then also just from a family dynamics point of view, how families respond. Because one thing that we hear a lot within bleeding disorders world is there is the patient, but then it affects a whole family. It affects that patient's siblings. It affects their parents, whoever else is at home. It's never just the individual. There's always a greater impact. And even at this stage where it's diagnoses and potential, like it's still, there's all these other humans whose lives intersect with this information. And it's interesting the way families respond to it, because it sometimes there are really negative responses, which in certain cases, I've seen people who I feel like their navigating of their circumstances was made harder because families reacted negatively to information about a disorder. Or like what you were saying earlier about, you know, you contaminating his clean, perfect genes. Like, you know, it's like it is funny. And yet at the same time, unfortunately, there are men who feel that way when it happens. And there are women who own that guilt all the more so, unnecessarily and incorrectly, because that was thrown at them. And
sure. Well, with my brother and his wife, it's the opposite, because my brother's the one from the dirty gene pool.
That's true. It can flip. Yeah, it can flip genders. It depends on what's going on, right?
Yeah.
Within hemophilia, because of the XY stuff, A and B is also X chromosome linked. So it's the same sort of passage through the bloodline.
Okay.
So there is a particular husband or male partner to female dynamic that you can see repeat a lot because of that.
Got it.
Yeah, it's not other. Our greater point here isn't a gender specific point. Just more that like those dynamics can really affect the bottom line.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and it was interesting when my brother found out about this heart defect, which was really, it was really recent. It was like 2 months ago. He called me and he had the same kind of reaction that I had when I saw like my 14 weird disorders that I genetically inherited. And he was like, I'm like so freaked out. Like, what if your baby has it? And like, should your baby get tested in utero? And I was like, I don't know. I'll ask my doctor, but like, don't feel bad, you know? And then after a couple of weeks, I think he like kind of got over it. But it is weird hearing that he was a star athlete his whole life. And he like, you know, is an endurance athlete specifically. And so to find out, I think that he had this heart defect was like really jarring to his identity. Sure. But then you kind of like move past and you're like, well, I have it, so, you know.
Well, it's funny when you can look in retrospect at things you've done with it before you knew. It's like you've done those. Like, you may not have tried to do that if you had known, like, you've got a heart thing. Like, you may have not tried that thing, but you did still have that thing when
you did that.
Like, it's an interesting kind of reverse engineering way at looking at what's truly possible with some of these conditions, that you can start to think like, oh, I can't do that. I'm not able to do that. I'm told I shouldn't do that. You know, ignorance can be bliss. So when you don't know, you just go do. And then in hindsight, it's like, look, you did it. Like, you're more capable than you think, which I think is also an important message when people, whether it's as a young child or as an adult, find out you have something. It doesn't necessarily mean there's limits on your life, that the moment you hear about it, it might feel that way. But when you actually break out the information and slow down, it doesn't actually necessarily mean much of your life needs to change.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's kind of where my parents are coming from in terms of like, we don't want to know, because, you know, like if we hadn't done the whole fertility rigmarole thing and we had just tried getting pregnant naturally, we wouldn't know about any of this bleeding disorder stuff or anything else. And so we might have had like a way, like I might go through a natural childbirth and not see any symptoms and never be the wiser that I have this. And like, that could have saved us a lot of stress and a lot of extra doctor visits, you know? So I don't know. Like, when I talk about this stuff with my mom, she's like, you know, I think you guys know too much. Like, I think these days you know too much about your bodies. And I'm like, all right, yeah. Or something could go wrong and it could save my life. So
right. Alternatively,
you don't know.
Yeah. Which in that case, knowing is way better.
Yeah, knowledge is power.
That's the double-edged sword of, like we were talking about with aneurysms and brain aneurysms and false positives. And it's like, if someone is genetically predisposed, but you can't, but there's false positives and there's no way to actually do anything for something. And it's like, well, then, you know, this isn't really useful information if, if it's not going to actively
change,
inform
outcomes.
Any decision. Yeah, it's just going to make me more worried about my life. Like, I would prefer to just keep living. Like, I don't need that partial information that doesn't affect any outcome.
Right. Well, I think with all the at-home genetic testing now that's available and what the FDA curbing back on 23andMe and the different tests of what they're letting customers know based on their genetics. But I think it is because a lot of people are taking it and then going into geneticists and being like, oh my gosh, I have this, 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 and this. And it's like, well, like you're a carrier and this might not necessarily, it doesn't affect always, you know, and then some of them aren't accurate.
Like, which is also problematic.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's useful for medical information to be correct, first and foremost.
For sure. Yeah.
Do you have any kind of concluding questions or thoughts?
No, I just want to thank you for joining us. And
yeah.
It was very serendipitous that we met. And I really appreciate your honesty and vulnerability on the podcast.
All right. Well, thank you guys for having me.
It's
definitely been a learning experience for me. So appreciate it.
Moving into the parting shots for July. Parting shots, one last little bit of something to leave our listeners with, bleeding disorders related or otherwise, before signing off and saying goodbye until next month. I will go first this month, Natalie.
Good.
Thank you. My parting shot for this month is that I have entered a competition through Flywheel. So I have been cycling kind of like a madman for about the last year plus. I've gotten very, very into cycling and it's gotten me into the best health and fitness in my life. And they're currently running a competition for the top total point getter nationwide, male and female, to win an at-home bike and subscription service. And it's like a really valuable thing. And it happens to coincide with Natalie and I looking for some kind of at-home bike situation. So I was like, hey, babe, I think this summer part of my life is competing for this bike. I have to go to more classes and score more points. So I'm doing that now. I'm recording this. Technically, today's day two of this three-week competition. By the time people are hearing this, week one is in the books. And theoretically, we should have already gotten a look at the week one leaderboard to see what's going on. So as part of my helping stay adherent to this and committed to this, and also because it's kind of fun, wherever I'm at, I'm going to screenshot that and I will send that out through the bloodstream. Well, I'll send it out through my social channels and then we can reshare through bloodstream. So if you're interested to see how the HEMA is doing in the national biking competition, it's also a great way to help me get ready for next month. Natalie and I are going to be going to Save One Life's ride for Barry. So Barry Hardy, who we lost earlier this year, he was a huge bike rider and did these cross-country bike rides to raise money and awareness for the HEMA in the developing world. Save One Life is honoring Barry with a ride in the Northeast this summer that Natalie and I are going to both be participating in. So I also feel like it's just good training and prep for that because I got to be ready to go biking on them streets, which I do have some legit fear and anxiety around. So the more comfortable I feel in my body and health-wise on a bike, the better. So that's it. I'll give you updates as they come. So keep eyes out for that. And that's my parting shot.
And then in the August episode,
I guess, yeah. We'll have to let you know how it went, let you know if we have a bike
an
in
at-home
our house.
Bike.
And I guess we'll also be letting you know how things went in Maine, or in New England rather, for Barry's ride too, by the next time we record as well, I think, date wise. Or am I wrong?
You're wrong.
Okay, so that'll be after that.
Well, but I think we'll be on our way.
We'll be on
New
our
England.
Way. Okay. All right, so you'll get some kind of update about it next month and then thereafter as well. But that's mine. What's your parting shot?
My parting shot is, so in the last 8 weeks, I've had two surgeries. Not terribly serious, nothing to worry about. But what has been interesting to me is the healing process. And I'm someone who typically has no problem like slowing down, napping, resting. And what I've noticed in this period of high vulnerability is that like all I've wanted to do is speed up. Like when my body actually needs me to lean into like the softness, I like want to accomplish everything.
And what do you attribute that to?
I that it's incredibly vulnerable to lean into vulnerability. And so it's just been like a really interesting thing to see. You know, I haven't really had that many medical issues or concerns in my life. And this year has sort of been a evaluation of health and has caused me to like kind of get skittish around it and not want to actually lean into my healing. So it's just, I have a greater appreciation for people who have to slow down for their bodies.
And how challenging that can be.
Yeah. And how challenging there's obviously a very heavy physical aspect to recovering from surgeries.
Right. But the mental and emotional
But the mental
component.
And emotional was blindsided me. It came out of nowhere in terms of me not like realizing how much it would impact me.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and two, I think you're a very confident person and a very self-assured person. So I think if you're used to operating from a place of confidence and self-assuredness, to like, it's uncomfortable for anybody to be vulnerable to some degree or another. But if you're used to operating from this place of confidence and self-assuredness, and then you're pulled into a place of you're very vulnerable, it just feels like it's all the greater stretch away from your normal, which is going to make it all the more
shaky.
Challenging.
Yeah,
rattling to,
for
to
sure.
you. So yeah, it's been interesting to watch your process through that too.
Yeah. So it's been humbling and I'm doing good.
You are. So. Yeah, thanks for sharing.
Thanks.
And with that, that's all for this episode. So special thanks to everyone at Believe Limited, the National Hemophilia Foundation, Entertainment to Effect Change, the Hemophilia Alliance, and our sponsor, Shire. Thanks, Shire. Thanks as well to Lydia Ruiz for sharing her An Unexpected Blessing story, and to Rebecca Haber for being our interview guest. Subscribe to the Bloodstream Podcast, the Ask the Expert Podcast, the Powering Through Podcast, and the Bloodline special series of podcasts on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. See, I changed my voice. That's how they're
podcasts.
Different. You can email us at mailbagpodcasts. Listen to podcasts. You can email us at mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. You'll also find Bloodstream on facebook.com/bloodstreammedia and on Twitter @bloodstreaminfo. Reminder to check out the program notes for this episode, especially to hear the community news in 60 seconds, which you probably barely heard when we did it, in your podcast player or on bloodstreampod.com for links and additional information about the stories featured on this episode. As always, my name is Patrick James Lynch.
And I'm Natalie Lynch.
And until next time, take self-care of yourself. Bye-bye, everybody.